You're listening to the Prepper Recon Podcast. For questions, comments, and podcast archives, go to PrepperRecon.com. Today's guest is Scott Hunt from Practical Preppers. Scott is also well known from his YouTube channel, Engineer775. Scott, welcome to the show.
Hey, Mark. It's good to finally get to do this with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. 2020 is off to a bad start. Looks like things are heating up in the Middle East with the attacks against the U.S. Embassy in Iraq and subsequent strike against Iran's top military general. You think this is stuff that preppers need to be keeping their eyes on?
I do. I mean, we're off to a, like you said, off to a very fast start here. So I just tried to catch up with all the news and articles today on it and getting back into town. It's like, wow. So things are heating up. I see when there's articles like that, there's a lot of emails coming in. Hey, I need a this or that. What do I do for water? So I hate to say it, but it can be good for business in what we do.
It stuff like that does tend to be a motivator, doesn't it? Because we go to Florida, you know, for a little piece of the winter to get away from some of the dreariness. And typically the first thing I do is load up on my gas can so that something pops off, I know I've got fuel to get back home. And I've been procrastinating on that. So I actually just got back from the gas station right before we start recording. I want to make sure that if something happens and the power goes out, that I've at least got gas to get back to the retreat in the mountains. So it's a motivator.
So we don't. Yes, it's definitely a motivator to pay attention. So, but I've dealt with a lot of folks and a lot of customers over the last 10 years or more, and I just like try to redirect them to focus on what, you know, it is. These things are all little wake up calls, but you know, are you prepared? And a lot of people are prepared in their minds. They're not actually doing anything, and they're just wrapped up in the news and events and what ifs and things coming down the road in 10 years, possibly. It's like, focus on some solutions and you'll take a lot of stress off and you won't have to be so, you know, freaked out about what's going on in the news. If you've got a plan, because you can't really control what's going on in the Middle East. You can't control what's going on in the world. So, you know, just alleviate a little bit of stress in your own life and your families by being prepared. It calms a lot of people down to have just know that they can take care of themselves for whatever period of time they decide.
Right. Yeah. And if you call up Practical Preppers and say, I want a solar powered water pump for my well tomorrow, that's probably not going to happen, is it?
Well, we can start the process. We'll put you on the schedule.
Yeah.
Getting it in tomorrow. No, it needs to be thought out and what, you know, we'd have to go through that and get it ordered. No, but it is an instant thing.
And I suppose we'll know soon what Iran's capabilities are, particularly as far as cyber and so forth.
We're going to find out. People are pretty prideful thinking that we're, you know, I see the memes with camels versus aircraft carriers and stuff like that. But they're being supported and funded by a lot of people that have technology. So I imagine they have some stuff that could do some damage.
Yeah. And cyber is one of those things that it doesn't take a huge program. You just need to recruit the right kids from the right hacker conferences, I guess. And you can really cause some trouble if you got a little money.
Disruptive. Yeah. Yes. Definitely. And they've got it. They seemingly have it. Well, we sent them a lot. They should have it.
Yeah. Yeah. Pallets and pallets of money. Scott, when did you first get into preparedness?
Oh, boy. I mean, for me, it's been like a homesteading, and it's been a hobby of mine for 25 years, I guess. Buying a piece of property, a small farm, and seeing if I could live here and be sustainable before people were talking about prepping, before Y2K even. Y2K kind of made me think about preparedness more than I was before. It was just like, okay, I want to have some cows and chickens and see if I could grow my own food and have my own water source and just see if I could be sustainable while I was an engineer at Michelin Tire. Prepping wasn't really on my mind, but homesteading was. And then the more and more, as things progress, more people start talking about prepping, and I said, "Oh, I do this. This is what I enjoy doing." And so I just got into it that way. Y2K kind of was a jump start. I had put in a hydraulic ram pump and a stream to pump water without electricity, and I said, "Hey, if something happens, I have a non-electric way to get water on my homestead, so I'll be good to go there." So it started with water preparedness in relationship to Y2K. And then I just kept tinkering around with those kinds of technologies, and I got into solar water pumping, and then the preparedness movement just started to come on. And by that time I had experimented a lot of things to do with water and a lot of different technologies to move water and charging batteries, and got into, so what other resource do I have on my property? I've got sunshine, I've got biomass or wood, I have elevation. And just started looking at properties from a resource management standpoint. It's like, how can I use the property better than people normally use it? And think about all the different ways, and, you know, picking a good property. A lot of people have horrible properties from a resource management standpoint. You know, they build their house on the north side of the hill and they don't have water and things like that. And so I run into a lot of those. People want to be prepared, but they're starting off in a hole, literally sometimes. And so I guess that got me into prepping, was the homesteading lifestyle, sustainability. And then I'm like, when the prepping movement took off, it's like, hey, I've been working on this stuff for 10 years. I'm ready to share what I know. So I started the YouTube channel.
And then you were on the very first episode of Doomsday Preppers with David Kobler, right?
Yeah, we were the pilot for that show, and we said, well, let's do it. And we really wanted them to call it American Preppers, but they wouldn't listen to us. At that time, it was American Choppers, American Pickers. There were some pretty, you know, popular television programs, and like, American Preppers would be really cool. But they quickly went sideways and sensationalized things, and it became, as you know, Doomsday Preppers. But we hung in there, and we started to work with them, and decided we would score the preppers that were on the show. As opposed, they were going to cast us again. We said, no, we don't want to go through that again, put our families through that again. And we became consultants for National Geographic, for the production company that was making the show, and did that 4.5 seasons.
And despite the sensationalization of it, it got a lot of people thinking about what's possible. You know, there were a lot of us that were already watching what was going on. Some of us probably had a couple weeks, maybe a couple months of food stockpiled, but no real plan to take prepping to the next level. And I know it pushed me to accelerate my efforts. So I think the show was a very positive thing, and I think it really got a lot of people motivated and headed in the right direction. And I think there were a lot of people thinking about it, and they didn't really have the term prepper, and they didn't really know right. The basics, and it just opened up a lot of people's minds, I think.
That's good, because I look at it negatively, because we were always battling with them to try not. It's like, these people are really nice. Don't make them look crazy. Don't make them look foolish. They're really diligent, responsible people. So I always have, I'm like constantly fighting with the production company. I was like, stop doing this. Stop making them look silly or making us look like we don't know what we're talking about. And so it's nice to hear you say that it was good. It allowed people to have a conversation about preparedness.
Yeah.
And say, hey, what do you think of that Doomsday Preppers episode? Was that crazy or what? But if people got to, you know, they got to talk about what they've been thinking about, you know.
Sure, and I think it gave a lot of people a lot of ideas, and I'm sure there's a lot
of
preps that are implemented today that would not have been had it not been for that show.
That's good. Thanks for straightening me out on that, Mark.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it was really, it was like, oh, because as it went on, there, you know, a lot of the good, you know, people that I would consider really good preppers did not want to be on the show because they were casting. It got to where they couldn't, they're finding it very hard to cast people. So they were taking anybody from criminals to whatever. It got pretty bad in the casting department. So, you know, the first couple of seasons were good, and it kind of tapered off, in my opinion.
And how long have you had your YouTube channel?
I mean, I started one in 2009, started in 2009, but really didn't get going until I'd say 2010 was when it was like, oh, this is not just a channel to, I've started a channel to keep in touch with my brother who was in Pennsylvania at the time. And so I didn't start it to do, it was just a generic, it just made up a name. Engineer was taken, Engineer 7 was taken, Engineer 7. I said, like, I kept going until the numbers, there was no forethought into my channel name. But once you have a name, you kind of stick with it and go. So I'd say 2010 is when I really started thinking about putting up videos about what I was doing.
And lots of conservatives have had negative experiences with YouTube. Have you noticed a drop off in viewership? Or, I mean, I know you're not really very political on your channel, but have they still targeted you?
Yeah, a lot of people have asked me. It's like, what is going on with your channel? You're putting out all this stuff, this new information, and you're not getting the viewership. And When you're on YouTube and you're a partner, you actually have sometimes a consultant that works with you, and they drop. She's completely vanished. And, you know, they would tell you, here's little tricks and tidbits and creator studio stuff, and they'd invite you to places like L.A., and it just, all of that went away. Can't even get a hold of anybody. They won't talk to me. So my viewership went way down, my, you know, views, it doesn't, and you can't figure it out other than I've been, you know, targeted, I guess. I'm associated with, you know, obviously conservative, right wing, I guess. But yeah, I don't know how they're, you know, they can scan and pick up any words and know what you're doing, but because we've been talking about it lately, it's like, man, I have my, I mean, I'm putting out just as many videos, but the views are way down. And I guess I'm just boring. It's just boring infrastructure stuff I do. So
I think it's also association. You know, people watch your channel, and then what else? The people that watch your channel, what else do they watch? I think they use that. You know, because it's all AI and algorithms and stuff, and they're certainly determined to take us all out.
There's that. There's definitely that, but then just. The, you know, we want to help you because we're making money off of you, that went away, you know, because people that, you know, will play the game get featured, they feature a video. I had one video that was featured by YouTube, and they told me they featured this video, and it made $35,000. And it was just a silly 10-minute video. I'm like, how is this happening? What is going on here? YouTube decided to feature it and promote it, and it just went crazy for no reason. Compared to any other video that I've done. And so, yeah, if you play the game, you do well. YouTube, if you don't, well, so I'm thankful for the amount of subscribers I have. I have a good, you know, base, and it helps me. I do get a lot of work from it. So, and all over the place. I've been in this year, Canada, Wyoming, Texas, all over the Southeast. It's been nuts. So I'm still grateful for YouTube. In case Google's listening.
Of course they're listening.
I know.
We're going to keep using them until they completely shut us down. And you know, it's shadow banned now, but then, you know, the people like Alex Jones that are completely outright banned, you get too much clout and they just erase you. And that's the culture of the left, that coexist bumper sticker they all have. It's not very realistic when you look at their actual ideologies.
No. Now when that first symbol there would take them all out.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Talk to us about Practical Preppers. What does your company specialize in?
We specialize in we do consultations on all types of preparedness, but our focus has been mainly in the last 5-6 years on getting people infrastructure that would work in a grid down situation. So we go through and come up with a plan for water and hot water and heating and cooling and everything that they would need to have, you know, most of the creature comforts we've gotten used to keep their communications going, just come up with all sorts of plans. But the prior, I guess primarily we've been working on water and power, but we've gotten into a lot lately where we'll basically take a whole house. I don't care if it's we're doing a 5,000 square foot house in Tennessee now that's brand new construction, and basically making it completely operate off the grid if need be. So we have been it's been great to, I've been all over the country. So geographically, whether it's frost lines that are 6.5, 7 foot deep, or, incredibly cold temperatures, can we make this cabin in Wyoming at 8,000 feet go through the winter on just solar? And so we've tested a lot of things in the last 5-6 years that really work well. Technology's changing all the time, so we try to stay up with that and then implement it. We design systems, and they are systems. It's not just a one, we're not just working on your well pump. When we're working on your well pump, we're thinking about, what size battery bank you need, because we know you also want communication and keep the freezer going and some lights and medical devices. So it's a systems approach. My background is engineering, so I'm always thinking in that mindset of designing a complete system for you so that you're good to go. If the power goes off, you can focus on other things like security, medical, whatever, that your infrastructure is going to work. And that takes a lot of effort and needs to be in place. Like you said before, it's not something that happens instantly. You have to plan it out, put it in place, and practice. And does it really work? And do a grid down weekend or week and see that your system really works. So that's some of what we do.
Like you said, you do a lot of work putting in off-grid water systems. Can you talk to us a little bit about some of the sources and delivery options for water? Because, I guess that is, you talked about creature comforts a little bit, but that's not really a creature comfort. That's either you have it or you die.
Exactly. So water is an obvious thing that we need to take care of. And most people that we deal with, if they don't have a source of water on their property, we try really hard to get them to either drill a well, develop a spring, or work on a really good robust rain catchment system, or find a way to purify the local lake water, pond water, something like that. But I really try to focus people on getting a well. If they can get a piece of property that has a well, or if they can get one drilled, it's worth the investment. Now, the West Coast, as you go west, the well prices go through the roof, astronomical cost. On the East Coast, Southeast, typical well, $3,000 to $4,000. It's a good investment. That is your water source. It's easy to protect. And then we work on, and once a well is drilled, and once you have your water source, we determine what's the best way to get that water to your retreat. Is it pump it up a mountain and then gravity feed it down if you have elevation change on your property? That's my favorite. That's the least amount of failure modes. If I can just pump water when the sun's shining with a solar pump up a hill, then I can supply you the pressure and the volume of water you need for firefighting, for drinking, for sanitation, for your animals, and just size things appropriately. Had a lot of people that I've worked with that started off with a little homestead, and then they've added homesteads and RV parks and tiny houses, and I just did one where they needed twice the amount of water than when we started. So it's just get a good source of water like a well, and then design a system based on that well. Is that well 1,000 feet deep? Is it 10 foot deep? Do I have to lift water 100 feet? Do I have to lift it 800 feet? That kind of thing, and just figure out how much power we need via solar or generators to make sure that that pump is going to move that water in a grid down scenario. And then all different types of ways to, it's not just one pump in a well. It can be three. I've put four pumps in a well where I have a hand pump. I can have a standard pump in there that only runs off the grid. I can have a soft start pump that runs off my little Honda generator. There's combinations, motors up top, suction pumps. So, there's a lot of backups to the backups. I've had customers say, I want 5 or 6 ways to get water out of that well. I'm like, yes, sir. And so I have fun doing that. It can be a little crazy, a little Rube Goldberg-ish, if you know who I'm talking about. They're just making crazy, complex systems. Like, this is getting a little crazy, but people want backups to backups, and we provide those. So, yes, finding a source of water and then developing the right pumps system and take advantage of the sun and gravity is my favorite. Just using the sun to lift the water, gravity to distribute the water is the systems that I've got out there that from, like I said, in Canada to Florida that just work great. And so minimal, you know, I don't need bladder tanks. I don't need electricity. I don't need to be tied to the grid. And that's where I go. Now, if people are what I call flatlanders and they don't have elevation, then I will solar pump, make sure I can get water out of the ground, at least into a cistern. And then from that cistern, I can boost it with a booster pump or just set that tank up to at least have gravity fed water. I can, you know, flush the toilet, have water running into the house. It might not have pressure, but you don't need pressure. We're just spoiled. We like 65, 70 PSI showers. If I have water flowing, it's like the ice bucket challenge. If I take a 5-gallon bucket of water and dump it over my head, that's pretty refreshing, right? There's no pressure there. It's all volume. So if I can deliver a lot of water without the pressure, you still have water. You still can get the job done. And so there's all these little tricks that we've played to take advantage or to compensate for a lack of elevation, or, you know, it's like we don't have to use another pump. There's so many systems I put in where people thought that they had to have 50, 60 PSI, and they're living fine on 20 to 25, and they're very happy with it, and they don't need that extra pump, an extra failure mode. So we go through so many – every water system is custom. Everyone is different. But I will say solar water pumping is probably my favorite way to get the job done.
And now once we've got water – do we have any solutions for heating it other than boiling it over a fireplace or a fire pit?
I mean, you always have fire. You mentioned the first one is having the ability to start a fire to heat your water, all the way up to wood boilers that heat thousands of gallons of water and heat your home with. I mean, so there's that way to heat water with biomass. Then, you know, there's obviously propane and natural gas for as long as it's available. That's a very – anytime you can use flame, you're going to have the most BTUs, the most power needed to heat water. People do not realize how much energy it takes to heat water. It takes a lot of energy. I mean, to heat a 50-gallon water heater for your family takes about 8 kW, 8,000 watts of energy a day, and that's just – that's a lot of energy. That's why 25 to 30% of your power bills is water if you're on electric. So you have flame via propane, gas, or wood, and then you have electric ways of heating it. Obviously, that's not the most efficient, but we have found that that's sometimes the best when it comes to solar. I know it's kind of contradictory, but solar, we've been experimenting with just using solar panels to directly heat elements all day long is a great way to not involve plumbing, to use a standard cheap electric water heater, and to heat that water. I've been doing it for 2 years on my house now. I spend about $3 a month on heating water for our family. In the winter, I use a wood boiler. I don't spend anything other than putting wood on the stove. But using that electric approach, I don't have to. All I'm doing is running electricity directly to an element through a little, small little controller that keeps it safe. And heat water that way. So electrically, we heat it directly with solar. You can do solar thermal. Those are the systems that have copper pipes and drain down tanks and collectors up on the roof. They're very expensive. Because of the copper mostly and the plumbing, and it's backwards. Your heat source is up top, and your water. You need your hot water down low, so you have to pump this water. And so you require electricity to get it done. So there's another failure mode. If you don't have electricity, then you can't take advantage of that solar thermal. What other ways? There's heat pumps, heat pump water heaters, byproducts of running your heat pump. You get water. We've done a lot with hydronic chillers to make hot water. There's a lot of ways. I could bore you to death with making hot water, but it's one of the most overlooked preps by preppers. They just, how do I make hot water? People say, oh, I'm just going to make a fire. I'm like, yeah, but that gets old. If you have to take care of, you know, a dozen people every day, you know, you should come up with a good water heating plan. And it can be multiple. It can be propane. What I like to do is put solar first, let it do as much work as it can do, and then use an on-demand propane water heater that maybe only has to bring the water up from 105 to 120, as opposed to bringing your 50-degree well water all the way up to 120 degrees. Let something do that preheater. So a lot of times we'll have two or three solutions in line where you can directly heat water with the sun all day long, because these new water heaters are so well insulated that you could, the water you heat today can be used tomorrow. you don't lose any temperature, hardly, a couple degrees. So, and people don't realize, there's like 17 million electric water heaters in this country. Those are batteries, but people don't think of them as batteries. That's a thermal battery. If you charge that battery with the sun one day, you have this battery that will last for 24 hours for showers. So there's a lot of tricks when it comes to heating water, but if the propane runs out and you don't want to start a fire, what are you going to do? There's a lot of solar direct water heating solutions on the market today. Probably more than you wanted to know.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's great. What about electricity sources? What options do we have besides solar?
Yeah. You can start with thermoelectric, start small with thermoelectric generators. Anything that creates heat can create electricity. Things that you can put on a wood stove that charge a battery. They're thermoelectric generators or TEGs, TEGs. They're anything that has a delta T, a differential. A stovetop is a huge delta T. And so we've used those to charge batteries. You've seen the little fans that sit on a wood stove and they spin, the free fans. I don't know if you've seen those, but those are typically thermoelectric generators. And they make electricity, make a DC source. So that's a very small way, but it's not, if I can charge that 12-volt battery off of my wood stove, I have a ham radio set up. I can keep my battery. I have power to run, to at least for communication. And then we get into generators, from whole house generators to portables to PTO generators that sit on a tractor, generators that companion together. There's so many generators on the market, gas, propane, multi-fuel, tri-fuel type generators that can produce the electricity that you need, maybe not for your whole house, but maybe for a small critical loads panel in your house where you say, I have to run my well pump. I need to run my freezer. I would like to have some lights. I need to keep this medical device going, whatever it might be, the top 12 circuits in the house, that could be your generator panel. Now, the generator panel needs to be sized appropriately. You have to size that generator so that you can handle the loads in that panel. So that's where you need an electrician to pull the circuits out of your main panel over to a critical loads panel, size that generator appropriately. Now you have a system that can go. And a lot of people, when they have a generator, they just let it run until the power comes on. They don't realize they can manage that. You don't have to let it run. You can run your generator for 4 hours a day and do everything. Take your showers, freeze your food, and then shut that thing down for 20 hours and then start it again the next day. And you can really stretch out your propane or natural gas a long, long ways if you don't run the generators. The generator's just running away. What are they doing? Charging their cell phone, and they're burning up 20,000 watts. They're just wasting fuel. And so it's just thinking about how you use your generator. So electricity generators, of course, we mentioned solar and battery backup systems. There's wind, and depending on where you live, there's hydro, depending on where you live, hydroelectric. So those are the main, there's some cool, sophisticated, you can do it off of gasification. There's heat engines on the market that are coming that's just not available for the average consumer yet, where you actually take heat and make electricity. That's like the old steam engine, but this is modern. But we won't get into that. But there's a lot of ways to make electricity. And if you can just make a little bit of electricity, it goes a long, long way in keeping sanity in the home. We're talking because our phones are charged. We're able to communicate because the internet's up. Just having a little bit of electricity. You don't need to run everything, but you need to run your critical things.
What's the cost for a top of the line solar powered water system installed on an existing well? So for the pump and the panels, batteries, and install.
A dedicated solar water pump system, by the time you do that and you go through it all, you realize, there's a couple of ways that this goes. It's like, I give you a quote of $10,000 because this is what it's going to take to do a two-stage pumping system. And then you realize, man, I'd really like to have my freezer and I would like to have some lights. You end up redesigning it to say, with a little bit more money, I can give you a third of your house functioning versus just doing a dedicated water pumping system.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Now, if you have a, I get into that all the time. I can go, yeah, here's your awesome Grundfos solar pumping, water pumping system, booster pump combo, and the batteries and all this. And it's like, but you're not happy because all you have is water. I mean, you're happy that you have water, but you'd like to have a few more things. And for a little bit more money, we could redesign this whole thing and buy an inverter that will actually run the well pump that you have in your well right now. And I don't have to touch your well. So I just saved, $3,000 right there. And I put that money into the inverter or into batteries. Now I can run all sorts of loads. So you get quickly away from that, unless you do have a piece of property that has a hill behind your home that you could just direct drive solar water pump up to a plastic cistern and gravity feed your house. Then that is more economic, and it's also it's more economic, it's more foolproof. You don't have any failure modes like you do if the one inverter goes down. Then I don't have anything. My well pump's not going to work, my freezer's not going to work. So I look at the whole system. What is the best system? It doesn't make any sense to me to sell you this $10,000 system dedicated to just water when for $15,000 I could run most of your home, including the well pump.
Wow.
So it depends. I hate to throw out numbers because we've done systems from, $8,000 to $80,000. We just did one that's $120,000.
Right.
So it's totally, the number of people, the number of, square footage of the home, how much water do you need? Are we trying to heat the house on solar? Are we trying to, doing some crazy things out there? So I can't put a blanket number on anything. But I don't mind redesign. I mean, I have fun designing systems for folks. So we'll design a water system and you're like, man, my wife wants this and this and this. I'm like, okay, I knew it. Scrap that one and we'll design you what you really want. And it won't be that much more, but you'll have the ability to have for everybody to have a shower, stay clean like they are now and nobody's going to get sick. And you'll, have some creature comfort so you can focus on other things.
And I'm sure a whole house AC system's a tall order, but do you know of any low drain solutions that might be able to help cool a small bedroom?
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the biggest loads. We talk about hot water, and when we go into air conditioning and heating, and depending on where you live, it can be brutal. Most energy in the United States goes into starting motors and compressors. 60% of the power required is in starting motors and compressors, which are ridiculous. All our homes have 200, now I'm seeing 400, some 600 amp services. It's absolutely ridiculous. So I'm having fun. I think I can run most homes for under 50 amps. And if I can do that, then I can put, then we can run the entire house off grid and you have climate control throughout the house. But most homes have heat pumps on them that have what is called locking rotor amps. If you go look at your heat pump, whether it's a 3-ton or 4-ton, it takes 110 amps at certain times to start that. 110 times 240, we're into 25,000 watts. I need to punch that compressor to start it. You cannot afford to do that on solar. So a heat pump that's out there today is just not, it's just not conducive to a solar system. So what we look at are mini splits. Like if you have a home that's already built, it's already got heat pumps, but you need a place of escape in that home to stay cool or stay warm, that's when the mini splits, the ductless mini splits. Most people think of Mitsubishi, but there's a million brands out there now. They're all great. Europe's been doing it for 35 years and we're just finally getting into it. So the ductless mini split is something that starts at 0 amps and ramps up to meet the load or the demand. And they don't use much power at all, usually under 1,000 watts to run a 1-ton mini split. So you can easily take care of a bedroom, or maybe you have what is called the bunk room where everybody can gather and get a good night's sleep, or, it's a place that people can get can stay cool or stay warm, and then add that one device to the house as opposed to trying to redo all your ductwork. Because it's very, very hard. It's very challenging. Now, when we start from scratch, there's hydronic chillers. People don't know about these yet, but they're for homes. They're chillers. You're basically heating and cooling your house with water. And the outdoor units are like mini split units. They start with 0 amps and they ramp up. And those are very easy to match up with solar. So, and they do, they make hot water as a byproduct too. They're making hot water or cold water, so they're awesome to do your domestic hot water. You mentioned that before. So I can do with a chiller, I can heat my water for showers, and I can heat or cool simultaneously my home. And they're soft start. So that's what, but the industry's not set up for that. They're, you know, the refrigerant guy, the HVAC guys do refrigerant, and they see a chiller and like, that's a plumbing job. So I've been having a hard time finding people that understand it. And, but the technology's there. That's what I have. For 2 years, I've had a chiller on my house. That's how I heat and cool, and with water. So I do everything I possibly can with water. But the key is getting soft start compressors, things that don't need a tremendous amount of water of energy to start them. Once they're running, most things are appliance. You hear of an Energy Star appliance. Yes, they're efficient once they're running. But to start it has been the problem. And now with these soft start inverter-based compressors, you can – it's just like a little Honda generator, a little inverter generator. You see – like refrigerators that have inverter compressor on them. I don't know if you've noticed that, but there's a lot of appliances now that say inverter this, inverter that. It's just they start at zero and they ramp up. That's what you want to be looking for appliances or soft start inverter based compressors. And then you can put solar to them.
And insulation's a good investment, right? Because if you keep that air cool from overnight, yeah, then you can be comfortable.
I mean, Yeah, I mean, if I can start from scratch with somebody, there's a whole science of building materials and how to insulate and how to frame a house. They got insulated studs now. You know, the sheeting between the stud and the outside has an insulation barrier. If you can save yourself a ton of money by doing passive solar designs, insulation, airflow. There's a lot of things that aren't implemented in most homes. I don't get that opportunity a lot, but when I do, it's a lot of fun to work with a builder, start from scratch. I've done 3 houses this year, and it's just fun because it's like, yes, they're doing it. They're following it. And I've got, you know, a 5,000 square foot house running under 50 amps. That's unheard of. You know, they put a 400 amp service in because that's what they thought they were going to need. They don't. They need 50 if it's done right. So it's a lot of fun. So the building, yes, I'm not a builder by trade, but I see I'm working with homes. So I see the different building materials that people are using all over the country. And it's nice to get hooked up with some, you know, builders that know what's going on in terms of how to keep this house. Just like you mentioned, is it insulated properly? A lot of things, people don't even know what's available. They don't know what's available for building. So they just get a builder, a contractor, and he builds the way they've been building for the last 70 years, backwards. encasing or your crawl spaces or how you handle your attics. We've just been building incorrectly. Power companies love it. Keep building the way you're building. they're making a ton of money. If you want to look at it from a preparedness standpoint, it's not just a preparedness. It's a frugal thing to do, is to be able to have no power bill using renewable energy is a lot of fun, but you got to start from scratch. You got to put the right appliances in, especially air conditioning and hot water. If you handle your climate control and your water right, you're well on your way to do that. I need to add some more solar to my place. My bill, I run about $35 to $40 a month, and my family just doesn't pay attention. Doors are open. It could be zero if we conserved, but we don't. And so I'm adding some more solar. It's been a hobby of mine to net zero my place, and it can be done. And it's kind of fun. It's been fun and rewarding. Even if people are grid tied and they're not prepping, just to see that their power bills are zero for the rest of their life. That's rewarding for me. And they're very happy about it.
I've seen some ads recently for products which are designed to protect vehicles and homes from EMP damage. I've got a prepper buddy who worked for NASA for several years, and I asked him about these devices, and he looked into it himself and asked a colleague of his who is still an engineer with NASA, and they both doubt the effectiveness of these devices. Are you aware of any simple plug-and-play type devices that would protect a vehicle or a home without an enclosed Faraday cage around the equipment being protected?
Yes, without, leaving Faraday cages to the side, because we know that works, but some things just can't be Faraday caged, like airplanes. But you have, there's equipment on the market that is certified as EMP hardened. There's devices that have different levels of military spec certifications that are EMP hardened. There's materials you can buy to help harden a space. There's several devices on the market. There's a lot of, I get contacted a lot. I know we've kind of mentioned this before. There's, I won't name names at this point, but there are systems out there, and all three parties are disagreeing with each other that I deal with on who's does what, and that doesn't work. And so I like a systems approach. You can EMP harden a home, but if there's no electricity, coming to your home, then how are you going to run anything in that home? It really doesn't matter. Where if you have solar panels and they're protected, and you've protected your devices, say your freezer, refrigerator, whatever, microwave, and the whole system's protected, then you have a chance at it. But if you have a device that's just attached to your house, what is it doing? It's protecting your house, okay? Protect your device, but there's no electricity coming. So you can't run it anyway. So this is a very touchy question, because I've asked all three parties that I know, from the PhDs in EMP hardening to in academia, in the military, and people that build Faraday cages for the Air Force. I've been involved with EMP stuff for a long time now, and I've been trying to get them together. It's like, stop, the egos get involved, I see a lot of these systems and components that could complement each other if they would put their heads together, but they're not. They're all individual, and they're like, their stuff doesn't work. I'm suing him. And so there's lawsuits going on with this in the EMP device world. So I don't know who to believe. I mean, I have the certifications on these products. I mean, I'm installing an EMP hardened system, and it's certified as EMP hardened, but I can't prove it. I don't have an EMP gun. I wish I could just put a device. I've seen some devices that it's a glorified lightning arrester, and it could be sold for a lot of money. I mean, I know people make improvements, but some of the stuff that I've seen is, $5 worth of parts being marketed for $500. So I don't know. I wish there was a simple thing. I know a Faraday cage works, but you can't put a Faraday cage around your car and drive it too well. So I don't know if I avoided or did I get away from answering this question yet?
Yeah, I think that was great.
So I wish there was a device that worked for everything. I think the technology is out there, to do a lot to protect your gear. If the companies that are doing EMP hardening would actually stop fighting with each other, we'd have something really nice. I've seen it at a mill. I mean, I've talked to the guys that build stuff for the Air Force. I've seen the welding teams. To do real EMP hardening is extremely crazy expensive. The materials to stop an EMP from coming down a transmission line is just expensive. So there's different approaches to it, from the Faraday cage to the high tech that, that say they can handle E1, E2, and E3 waves. But we're like one of the only dealers in the country that Practical Preppers is that sells an EMP hardened inverter. And that's a shameless plug, but we do install them. We put, to harden, we protect the appliances all the way to the solar panels.
And is that standard or is that an upgrade?
That's an upgrade. That is an upgrade. But it's a $1,200 upgrade. And for the size of the system, you're talking a $40,000 to $60,000 system. Well, that's installed, turnkey, done, permitting, everything. Say $50,000 for a big system that will run most of your home. That's an 8,000-watt inverter and can surge to just about 20,000. with an EMP hardening package of $1,200, it's not a lot to add on to get that.
Yeah, I don't think I would bother getting it without that. that's a pretty cheap insurance policy, considering it's an insurance policy in the first place, and EMP is probably at the top of most people's list that are thinking about getting that insurance policy. So,
I've been on an EMP, it wouldn't make sense to do it without it. Yeah, I've been on an EMP task force. I've been, I've heard a lot, learned a lot about it, and I went with Solark out of Texas because they seem to know what they're doing. They have the background in it, their own testing labs and third party testing, and it just makes sense to me from an engineering standpoint. This is the right approach to EMP hardening. Now, the other little gizmos out there, they could be additive. They could help, but I don't know. I just don't know. I've been contacted a lot by them, and there's several out there. And there's some, I just don't think you can put a device on your house and call it EMP hardened. Now, you could be truthful and say, okay, this is going to stop me from an E3. This is going to stop a solar flare event from getting into my house. Maybe. But what about, E1, E2? Forget it. It's not going to do it. So there's limitations. So are they being honest in their marketing? That's all. Is it going to stop an E1 wave? No way. Is it going to stop an E2? Doubtful. E3, maybe. Okay. But there are lightning arresters out there by Midnight Solar that will do that. So anyway, EMP is, there's a lot of opinions, and the internet's full of them. Anyway, that's probably all I'm going to say about EMP.
Well, Scott, we really appreciate your time today, and thanks for doing everything you do for the community. And we look forward to talking to you soon. Can you tell folks, where do they go to find your work on YouTube and then on the internet if they're interested in maybe getting some type of a system like this set up?
Yeah, sure. Thanks again, Mark, for the opportunity. Yeah, Engineer775 is my YouTube channel, and I have just a lot of videos. I basically video the installations that we put in all over the country, so you can get an idea of what we do, from water to power to generators to solar. And then on practicalpreppers.com is our website, and we have a store, and we have all our products and descriptions and ideas, and you can get a hold of me there, or info@practicalpreppers.com is my email address, and so be glad to help you. Appreciate the opportunity, Mark.
Scott, thanks again, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.